You're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT, stay tuned.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned. Today on the show, we're going to start the show by focusing on two different cases of Palestinians who were recently killed by the Israeli occupation. We will start with the story of Ubaida Jawabra, who is a teenager and was killed on May 17, 1 month before his 18th birthday. After we learn more about Ubaida, we're going to get updates about another case of a Palestinian who was killed by the Israeli occupation. This time is Ahmad Araikat. Ahmad was killed on an Israeli checkpoint less than a year ago. At that time, we covered this story and we played an interview focusing on his death. Today, I'm going to play a newer interview with his cousin and legal scholar, Noor Araikat, who will give us updates about his case, what did they discover after the investigation, and why the Israeli occupation is still not releasing the body of Ahmad Araikat to his family. Noora, she's going to talk about the case, but also discuss that within the larger practice of Israeli occupation, which seems to continue abuse the rights of Palestinians even after their death. But before we play the interview that focuses on Ahmad Araikat, I'm going to start by playing an interview that focuses on the death of the teenager Ubaida Jawabra. In this clip, you will also hear the voice of Ubaida talking about his reality, because a couple of years ago, when he was 15, there was a video made about him. He talked about his experience and also talked about his dream of becoming a chef. At that time, Ubaida was 15, still alive and able to dream.
We turn to look at the tragic death of one Palestinian teenager. His name is Ubaida Jawabra. Israeli forces shot the 17-year-old dead in the West Bank's Al-Arub refugee camp, where Ubaida grew up. He was the subject of a short film in 2019 produced by the children's human rights group, Defense for Children Palestine. In the film, Ubaida shares his experience as a Palestinian child facing violence under the Israeli occupation. Despite his young age, he was detained at least three times by Israeli forces, starting at the age of 14. This is Ubaida in his own words at the time he was just 15 years old.
My name is Ubaida Akram Jawabra. I'm from Arub refugee camp north of Hebron. I'm 15 years old and I like to cook. Arub refugee camp is full of small houses and big families. When you open your window, you'll see your neighborhood in your face. Its streets are narrow, but its people are friendly and brave. They stand with you when you're in trouble. Life is tragic for children here. They can't play like they're supposed to. There's no freedom. I've been arrested twice by Israeli forces. The first time was really difficult. I was on my way to the store when they arrested me. When they took me for interrogation, they bound my hands in a plastic cord. They used two of them so that I couldn't move my hands at all. My eyes were covered in a thick blindfold. It was also covered my nose and made it hard to breathe. When you're walking and can't see anything, you feel dizzy. You're scared and you hesitate. The soldiers told me there were steps, but there were none, so I'd fall. The soldiers would beat me in places that would leave no marks, so there wouldn't be any evidence on my body that I could use to testify against them. A lot happened to me in prison, and when I left, I noticed a lot changed. I had a lot of schoolwork to catch up on. I didn't know which subjects I was going to choose. I chose a vocational school because the schoolwork had piled up. I couldn't catch up. They gave me exams for 2 months, and I struggled a lot. Every day I had to finish a book to catch up.
When it produces a spark, you have to pull your hand back a bit, okay?
I wanted high grades to prove to the school administration that the effort they put into me was not for nothing, to show that prison will not affect me now.
I'm Rashid Arar, the vocational counselor at Arub Vocational School. As you can see, there's Route 60. Many Israeli settlers use it, and they cause a lot of problems for us. We are located in an area that sees a lot of friction. Sometimes the Israeli forces assault the children. Sometimes there are arrests and raids on the school. Some of the children have been to prison, and some are arrested while they are students here. In both cases, we find when these students come back to us, they can have trouble fitting in. It's not easy for them to interact with others or build relationships. A boy might have an unpredictable reaction to something. We help them restore some balance, get along with others, and focus on school, and help them get rid of some of their habits that could have negative effects on them.
I started to think, why are we so different from other children in the world? Why are we detained when we're young and made to suffer? While others are happy playing sports and with many opportunities that we don't have, why are they like that and why are we like this? To this day, no one can answer me.
Those are the words of Ubaida Jawabra in a short film made by Matthew Castle for Defense for Children Palestine. At the time, Ubaida was 15 years old. In the short film, Ubaida said he had dreams about becoming a chef after learning to cook while in Israeli military detention.
They brought in a cook from the other section of the prison, and he was looking for two or three to be his assistants. So we worked with him, and he taught us step by step. I learned how to cook and to work with others and how to be polite and respectful. I feel freedom, but it's not complete freedom. We first have to be liberated from the occupation before I can feel I am truly free. I feel freedom in that I can come and go, hop in a taxi, talk to anyone I want, argue with anyone I want. You have a personal will. You can do whatever you want. This was something that I missed when I was in prison. But we're not liberated, so how can I be fully happy? Only part of my happiness has been fulfilled.
The words of Palestinian teenager Obeida Jouabra, speaking when he was 15 years old. Israeli forces shot him dead just a month shy of his 18th birthday. We go now to the West Bank, where we're joined by Mariam Barghouti, a Palestinian writer and researcher. Mariam, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us more about Obeida and what happened to him?
Hi, thank you for having me, Amy. Obeida was shot near Al-Arub refugee camp in Hebron, and he was shot to the chest with a bullet by an Israeli soldier from not a very, the distance was not very far. And it kind of shows you the brutality of the Israeli army when they target these children, especially after having been arrested multiple times by the Israeli army. Obeida later succumbed to his wounds, but he is not the only Palestinian that was killed by the Israeli army and settlers. Since 2008, 1,220 Palestinian children were killed. And this is just from 2008. Of that, 1,152 were from Gaza. They were killed with the bombings that kept falling, that Israel keeps claiming as Hamas. We need to also remember Obeida's in Hebron. He lived in an area that is notorious for the settler violence that happens there. Hebron in 1994 witnessed a brutal massacre at the Ibrahimi Mosque, where an Israeli settler, Baruch Goldstein, went and fired at worshippers at dawn under the protection of the Israeli army. Obeida, and I say this with complete sorrow, is just one name in a long list of many.
And can you put that into the context of a fragile ceasefire? The deaths in Gaza alone, it looks like 243, about a quarter of them children, over 60 children. And then as a result of Hamas and other militant groups, 12 people dead in Israel, two of them children, two Thai workers.
Right. I mean, with this argument about Hamas, let's remember before 2007 and the takeover of the Strip by Hamas, Israel was still killing Palestinian children. Since 2000, 2,191 Palestinian children were killed. The Israeli army constantly targets Palestinian youth and children, but that's inevitable because we are a youthful population. More than 45% of Palestinians in Gaza are under the age of 18, most of them under 15 years of age. The Israeli brutality in Gaza was unprecedented, and this comes after many aggressions. The ceasefire right now, we celebrate it, we welcome it. We are so sick of counting the names of our dead being killed in the most savage way. But let's remember that this is a pause. What the ceasefire is a pause. Right now, we need accountability for children like Obeida. We need accountability for all the children that were killed in Gaza. If it's too difficult for the world to call for accountability for the killing of us adults, then at least the children. Let's focus on that maybe a little bit. Palestinians who are detained by the Israeli military experience brutal torture and repression. I was detained in 2014, and I was 20 years old for just a week, and it still lingers with me. That experience still lingers with me. So imagine a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old going through that experience. So I really think right now, let us hesitantly celebrate the ceasefire, but let us know that this is just one step in accountability for Palestinians.
Mariam Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us. And of course, we're going to continue to cover what is happening in Israel and Palestine.
Exactly a year ago, on June 22, 2020, another young Palestinian was killed by the Israeli occupation. This time, it was 27-year-old Ahmed Arekat, who was shot dead by the Israeli occupation at an illegal checkpoint. It was in the same day of his sister's wedding. Next, I'm going to play a clip with his cousin and Palestinian-American legal scholar Noor Arekat, who's going to give an update on this case and tell us what they discovered after investigating the circumstances around his death. She also is going to talk about why the Israeli occupation seems to still refuse to release the body of Ahmed to his family, which apparently is not unusual for the Israeli occupation to do, this continuous abuse of Palestinian rights even after their death.
And I wanted, Noora, for you to, if you could, because I know it is still so painful, talk about your cousin. The investigation you have done of his death at an Israeli checkpoint. And then as we begin to wrap up, put that in the larger context of what's happening today in the occupied territories.
Thank you for lifting up Ahmed Arekat, my cousin. Again, he was shot at a checkpoint separating two Palestinian cities, Abu Dis and Bethlehem, on the day of his sister's wedding. He had a mechanical error in the car, shot dead, 6 times above the waist in 2 seconds with his arms above his head, left on the pavement, even as the Israeli ambulance came to treat the lightly wounded Israeli soldier manning the checkpoint, refused to treat Ahmed. His body was not moved. The Israeli army also refused to allow Palestinian ambulance to treat him. The car was compounded. There was no autopsy conducted on his body, and he remains in an Israeli refrigerator at Tel Aviv University, held hostage to punish the family as well as other Palestinians, in a sign that even after death, they will be treated cruelly. He is one of 62 Palestinians held in this way in response to our advocacy to just get the body back, that included the forensic architecture investigation that demonstrated scene by scene that Ahmed was probably decelerating. Far from accelerating, was decelerating as the car comes out of control in response to mobilizing the Arekat family across the United States, who have also sought refuge here. Six senators we asked to intervene on the family's behalf with the Israeli government. In response, Defense Minister Benny Gantz became more cruel and said not only would they not release the body, but that they would dig up Palestinian bodies accused of participating in resistance activities to hold them hostage as well. The way that this fits within the larger frame has to do with Israel's expanding use of force. We have to be careful when we're calling for international law and to describe what Israel is doing as war crimes, because Israel's work is also in the battle of changing what the law means. It is shrinking who counts as a Palestinian civilian. It regards Palestinians as already always being a threat until proven innocent. All Palestinians are deemed a threat for their mere existence, and challenging the Zionist settler colonial mythology of uninterrupted Jewish spatial and temporal presence. What we see happen to Ahmed has been a pattern and practice that the UN has documented and said that Israel shoots as a matter of precautionary measure. In some cases, they have placed weapons alongside the Palestinian bodies. We saw this manifest most cruelly during the Gaza March of Return, when snipers shot down hundreds of Palestinian Gandhis, so to speak. For all those who keep saying, if only Palestinians would be peaceful, we have been nothing but. The question to ask is, how have Palestinians not been more violent, frankly, given this atrocious treatment? They shot hundreds of Palestinians, 90% of which in the head, in the neck, in the back, in the torso, as they were fleeing, medics, children. And the Israeli Supreme Court said that this was justified, because even the peaceful protests are, quote unquote, Hamas's new tactic of warfare against Israel. They have securitized our entire life, our entire existence, and the bare minimum of what an international community watching now that just cares about the violence during these spectacular moments. If you really, really sincerely care about the violence, you must place sanctions on Israel. You must demilitarize Israel. You must force Israel to sign the non-nuclear proliferation treaty. You must hold Israel to account. Otherwise, you are only asking Palestinians to die quietly.
I want to go now to Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv. As you listen to Noura Erekat, your latest piece in Haaretz, a pampered Israel carries out violence because it can. If the U.S., if Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the first Palestinian-American congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib, succeeded in stopping the expediting of $735 million of precision-guided weapons to Israel, would this have an effect? What kind of impact does this have on Israeli society? Do you think this could stop the bloodshed?
Let me tell you, Amy, that if there would have been an administration, American administration, who would like not only to stop this violence, but to put an end to the occupation, it could do so within months. The problem is that we never faced an administration who was really decisive or was really caring about the continuance of the status quo. You know, Biden is now labeled as Israel as a hostile president. This war, Joe Biden is signed on this war quite a lot, because if it would be a decisive American president, he would put an end to it at once. Don't forget that Israel is so depending on the United States politically, militarily, and financially. But Israel learned that the United States is in its pocket, that the support is unconditioned, that the money will come and the check is open no matter what Israel does. That's the lesson of Israel after many years. And that's the way that the United States had corrupted Israel. Because if you get this free supply of arms, like a free supply of drugs, you become addicted and you become totally corrupted, because you know there are no one to put limits to your behavior. What I wrote today in Haaretz was that Israel is by far too strong. Would Israel be less strong? It would be much of a moral state. Because Israelis are not bloodthirsty, they are not monsters. But they do all those things because nobody stops them. Because this overall power makes people arrogant. They can provoke the Palestinians in Jerusalem, and they can kill Ahmed Arikat in the checkpoint, and they can continue to steal their land and to do all those things, and the world just hugs Israel. And if the world hugs Israel, Israel continues. There will be no resistance from within Israel. I mean, Israelis will never wake up one shining morning and say, oh, this is not so nice, this occupation, let's put an end to it. Why would they, after 53 years in which they were told that without the occupation, Israel will not survive? The only way to put an end to it is to make Israelis pay and be punished, and then it will be their choice if they are ready to take this price. And I can assure you, most of the Israelis then will say no.
Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist, columnist for Haaretz, member of the editorial board of the paper, and Noura Erekat, Palestinian-American human rights attorney and legal scholar.
As we heard in the clip, it is often discussed that apartheid Israel would not be able to continue its violation of Palestinians' human rights with such impunity if one of the most powerful countries today, the United States, did not provide apartheid with all its support, whether it's financially, politically, or militarily. As we discussed in previous shows, Israel serves the imperialist interests of the United States in that region. So for an imperialist nation to give up on one of its main sources of control in a region, it has to be subjected to a huge amount of pressure, especially from its own people. It has to become a case where it is no longer politically viable to support apartheid without facing huge political consequences in their own countries. But as it's often discussed, this awaited pressure has been slow to come from citizens of the United States. Americans seem, in the best-case scenario, still confused on one of the clearest modern-day cases of occupation, colonization, and one of the most well-documented cases of apartheid today. An apartheid case documented even by Israel's own human rights organization. Now, this is, of course, mainly due to the unwavering support apartheid gets in mainstream media. Mainstream media has become, over the years, one of the main complicit institutions with apartheid, where instead of criticizing and investigating rhetorics coming from their own government, they really mainly turn themselves into a simple platform where the narrative of the oppressors and their allies spread freely. And this is, of course, not limited to Palestine, Israel. As we discussed as well before on the show, there have been recently glimmers of hope where we saw last month many instances where mainstream media seemed to finally maybe deciding to start doing its job again, if it ever did it really on Palestine, Israel. But of course, there are still a lot of people working in mainstream media not giving up, who are still insisting to continue to spread talking points of apartheid, maybe not realizing yet that this is the lost battle and that facts can no longer be hidden. Next, I will play a clip showing an example of that, where we will hear political analyst Omar Baddar pointing out at least 20 lies told recently by one single host who managed to pack them all up in just a few minute clip.
Bill Maher may have set the record for the greatest number of falsehoods or strawman arguments in the shortest conversation on Palestine and Israel. Here are 20 false or misleading claims he made last week in just a few minutes of talking about this.
I was watching this war go on in Israel.
Okay, first of all, this was not a war because only one side has an actual military with actual fighter jets and tanks. But even if you wanted to call it a war, it would not be a war in Israel because the overwhelming majority of the bombs were dropped on Gaza and the overwhelming majority of the dead were Palestinians in Gaza. And Gaza is occupied Palestinian territory that is not in Israel.
And it was frustrating to me because there was no one on liberal media to defend Israel, really.
All right, this one is so absurd, it really is hard to know how to respond. Yes, coverage was a little bit better this time. Instead of being uniformly pro-Israel, there was some recognition of Palestinian humanity, and there was some space for Palestinians to speak for themselves, but it was hardly the utopian coverage that Bill seems to be having nightmares about.
I'd also like to say off the bat that I don't think kids understand, when I say kids, I mean the younger generations, that you can't learn history from Instagram.
I mean, you can't learn all of the history on Instagram, but you can learn a hell of a lot more following informative accounts like the IMEU on Instagram than listening to uninformed people like Bill talk about this.
Dang. Well, Gaza fired 4,000 rockets into Israel. What would you say Israel should have done instead of what they did?
Are you leaving anything out here, Bill? I mean, was Israel minding its own business when rockets were suddenly fired out of nowhere? Or did it just skip your mind that Israel is suffocating millions of people in Gaza under siege and is carrying out ethnic cleansing in the West Bank?
I mean, what if Canada fired 4,000 rockets into America?
Again, is America occupying Canada and preventing Canadians from getting access to clean drinking water? Because if they were, then this would be an apt analogy. And we can talk about correcting America's behavior and then achieving peace through justice.
Or Mexico, which is an even better analogy because we actually did steal the land from Mexico. I would submit that Israel did not steal anybody's land.
This is the most ridiculous claim of them all. Israel was literally built on land theft and ethnic cleansing. To establish Israel, they destroyed more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages and drove out more than 750,000 Palestinians out of their homes.
This is another thing I've heard in the last couple of weeks, words like occupiers and colonizers and apartheid, which I don't think people understand the history there.
At this point, Bill is like a falsehood machine. Of course Israel is an occupier. It says it right there over and over in a mountain of UN resolutions and in the opinion of the International Court of Justice and in the reports of every major human rights organization in the world. And of course Israel is a colonizer. They are literally building colonies on stolen Palestinian land to the condemnation of the entire world. And of course, Israel is an apartheid state. You can just read the details of that in this recent Human Rights Watch report detailing Israeli apartheid. Or you can just watch this clip.
Okay. Captain?
The Jews have been in that area of the world since about 1200 BC, way before the first Muslim or Arab walked the earth.
Okay, now we're getting a little stupid, so let's clarify the issue. There are lots of civilizations that lived in Palestine, including the Canaanites and the Jews and the Persians and the Romans and the Byzantines and the Umayyads and the Crusaders and the Ottomans. There's no denying that there's a legitimate Jewish connection to the land of Palestine, in the same way that there's no denying that there is a Christian connection and a Muslim connection to the land. But in the same way that the Christian connection doesn't mean that the Vatican can come along and drive Palestinians out of their homes and claim the land, and in the same way that a Muslim connection to the land, which is a legitimate one also, doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia can come along and drive Palestinians out of their homes and claim the land. The legitimate Jewish connection doesn't mean that European Jewish settlers can come along and throw Palestinians out of their homes and ethnically cleanse them to create a Jewish state of Israel. That's what we're talking about here. This isn't about which religion came first. This is about whether the indigenous people of Palestine can be ethnically cleansed out of their homeland in order to create a Jewish state that denies the rights of non-Jewish inhabitants in the land.
There was never a country called Palestine that was a distinct Arab country.
It's really bizarre that you think this is relevant. Yes, Palestinians did not have a recognized independent state before the creation of Israel, and neither did the natives who lived in America before Columbus arrived. But that did not change the fact that they lived here and this was their land. The idea that it becomes okay to ethnically cleanse people out of their land that they've lived on for thousands of years simply because they did not have an independent state is just ridiculous.
The UN in 1947 said, okay, we're going to partition it. We have a map. I want to show it. People forget what the map looks like. This is what was on the table at the beginning. The green is the part that the Arab population would have gotten.
Once again, you're leaving out critical information, like the fact that Palestinians owned more than 90% of this land. And so, of course, they would reject a deal in which they would just have to give up half of their country. And of course, the other side would be eager to accept a deal in which they would gain a ton of land that they've never owned. As for the modern two-state solution, which has been around for nearly 30 years, in which Israel gets to keep nearly 80% of the land and leaving Palestinians with barely over 20%, it is Israel that rejected that deal and insisted on colonizing all of Palestine.
Hamas's charter says they just want to wipe out Israel. Their negotiating position is you all die.
I am certainly no fan or defender of Hamas, but the you all die claim is just made up. Their new 2017 charter is available for everyone to read. Also, if you're concerned about mass deaths, you may want to notice that it's actually the Israeli military that's responsible for the most killing of civilians here. And it's not even close. Back in 2014, they killed more than 550 Palestinian children in Gaza in the span of 6 weeks. Ever heard of the phrase, actions speak louder than words?
The two-state solution has been on the table a number of times. There could be an Arab capital in East Jerusalem now if Yasser Arafat had accepted that in 2003. He did not.
That's also not true. The capital offered to Arafat was Abu Dis, which is near Jerusalem, but not in Jerusalem.
I mean, they have rejected this and went to war time and time again.
You just don't know what you're talking about. Palestinians repeatedly said no to tiny and isolated and separated pieces of land that would not make for a viable Palestinian state. In fact, what Palestinians were being offered at the end of the so-called peace process was so ridiculous that even Israel's own foreign minister at the time said that had he been Palestinian, he would not have accepted it.
Camp David was not the missed opportunity for the Palestinians, and if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well. This is something I put in the book.
And, you know, as far as Gaza goes, it's amazing to me that the progressives think that they're being progressive by taking that side of it, the Bella Hadids of the world, these influencers. I just want to say, in February of this year, a Hamas court ruled that an unmarried woman cannot travel in Gaza without the permission of a male guardian.
This is yet another ridiculous straw man. No one is defending the regressive social and political attitudes of a Hamas-affiliated court. The Bella Hadids and the influencers are speaking out against Israel's killing of Palestinian civilians and children. And seriously, Bill, Shame on you for covering for those killings by dragging in the extraneous and completely irrelevant issue of an indefensible court decision.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is I think what she chanted with people. That is a PLO slogan that means Israel from the river to the sea, is that there will be no more Israel.
When the civil rights movement in America demanded freedom and equal rights, that was not a call to destroy America. It was a call to transform the country from an apartheid state into a country in which everybody's rights were respected equally. Likewise, the call for a free Palestine is not a call to destroy anything or anyone except the discriminatory apartheid regime that rules the land. It's a call for a more inclusive future in which every Israeli and every Palestinian can live together in freedom and equality.
That included the Arab Party.
Correct.
And once you're part of the government, they need your three votes in the Knesset to get to 61.
No apartheid state ever did. An apartheid we think of as South Africa. The Israelis, they have made mistakes, but it's an apartheid state because they keep getting attacked.
Wait, Bill is trying to have it both ways here. Which is it? Is Israel not an apartheid state, or is it an apartheid state because they keep getting attacked? You know, every apologist for a racist system has defended it by insisting that the oppressed have to be denied their rights because they are too wild or dangerous to enjoy equal rights. And this is fundamentally no different. It tells you everything you need to know about Bill's worldview and really that of the Israeli government, which is that they don't see Palestinians as equal human beings who are deserving of freedom and equality. And this is precisely why Israeli apartheid persists. And it's also precisely why this crisis will not end until Palestinian humanity is recognized.
While we continue to cover on the show US politicians, US mainstream media, and their complicity with apartheid, because the US role is very important, this does not mean that we forget about Canada. We, of course, always come back to Canada to see what we're doing here. And as usual, we keep getting proof that we are insisting on doing exactly the same as the US and be on the wrong side of history. I will play next a very recent clip by our own Minister of Foreign Affairs, Marc Garneau, who recently categorically refused to describe Israel as an apartheid state, even though it has been recently documented as such by Israel's own human rights organization, B'Tselem, by Human Rights Watch, which is a very mainstream human rights organization. It's always important to note that these reports only confirmed what Palestinians and their allies have been saying for years. Despite all of that, our own foreign affairs minister insists to be a supporter of apartheid, and he seems to insinuate at the end that if you are critical of Israeli apartheid, you must be a bigot.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will simply say that the position of the Liberal government is extremely clear on the question of the apartheid label. We reject it categorically. It is not part of our approach with respect to the Israel or the Jewish community. And we, of course, are completely against any anti-Semitism that would be displayed by any Canadian citizen.
So ridiculous. Canada clearly here is on the wrong side of history. It may not be obvious to the party right now, but it's going to be obvious to them in hopefully 10, 20, if we have to get there, years. But at some point, it will become obvious just how wrong people parties like the Liberals and others who are unwilling to call out Israel's human rights abuse. It'll be so clear just how wrong they were.
This is a clip from the Rational National. In the same episode, the host also pointed out a tweet from Michael Bookard, who says, and I'm quoting, in response to Marc Garneau's statement about the label, as he called it, of apartheid. The tweet says, just this year, the word apartheid has been adopted to describe Israel by B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, the post-apartheid governments of South Africa and Namibia, and two former Israeli ambassadors to South Africa. But Canada reject the word, quote, categorically. Whose opinion would you trust? Again, this was the tweet that Michael Bookard posted on June 11. Michael Bookard is the vice president of CJPME, which is Canadian for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. Michael tweeted again on June 22nd on the same topic, and I'm quoting, "Canada's categorical rejection of the term is absurd." Then Michael explains, and I'm quoting again, "Half a dozen Israeli human rights groups participated in a conference today on, quote, apartheid in Israel, including B'Tselem, Yesh Din, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, Peace Now Israel, Gisha, and Breaking the Silence. Human Rights Watch was also at the conference," unquote. So while all these human rights organizations in Israel are discussing apartheid in Israel, Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister is taking upon himself to be the biggest defender of Israeli apartheid and categorically deny what is a simple fact today, that even Human Rights Organization Israel cannot deny and are meeting to discuss. Next, I will play another clip that looks into the role of Canada in the violence against Palestinians. This report was done by students from the Concordia University Television, CUTV, looking into Montreal in particular and how possibly Montreal-based companies are selling military equipment to Israeli apartheid.
Are Canadian companies contributing technology to the Israeli military? As recent bombing campaigns have destroyed homes and killed 66 Palestinian children, how is Canada, and Montreal in particular, contributing to violence in Gaza? Local 514 investigates. In the aftermath of Israel's bombing of Gaza, Canada is pledging aid. But at the same time, Canadian exports to Israel are on the rise, and some of the weapons are produced right here in Montreal. Pratt & Whitney Canada, located in Longueuil, have produced PT-6 turbine engines manufactured for various utility aircrafts used by the Israeli Air Force. Most of these engines were not directly exported to Israel, but subcontracted by companies in the United States and one in Italy. In cases such as this, Global Affairs Canada would assess the human rights records of Italy and the United States, and not the countries that are acquiring these aircrafts for their militaries. From 2000 to 2019, Israel has been the top 18th country to receive engines for military use from Pratt & Whitney Canada, as the company provided $42 million worth of engines within this time period. Global Affairs Canada told Local 514 that they cannot comment on specific exports or export applications, and that they have an obligation to protect confidential information considering the commercial activities of individual companies. Kelsey Gallagher, researcher for Plowshares, says if we included all subcontracted exports to Israel, the number of total military exports to Israel will be much greater than documented by the government of Canada.
So we don't have an overall estimate. The last record that we have in our own internal database was for the export of 12 PT-6B engines for use in Israeli aircraft. We priced the engines at about $1 million each. So this deal would have increased Canadian military goods by about, you know, $12 million. The deal was signed in 2019. We're not sure when the exports actually happened. But $12 million would have effectively, you know, really doubled Canadian military exports to Israel for that year, just for this one deal. These companies exist to sell weapons, right? And they're not voluntarily going to not sell to countries. This is why we need strong regulations. We need the Canadian government to step in, regulate this trade, because we were talking about people getting killed, right? We're talking about civilian harm events.
Bell Helicopter Textron Canada, located in Mirabel, an off-island suburb in Montreal, produced the Bell 206 helicopter, which was used by the Israeli military since the 1970s. Last year, the Israeli Air Force decided to replace the Bell 206 with an Italian-made aircraft. Canada has committed $25 million in humanitarian aid to Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza a week after a ceasefire was declared between Palestine and Israel.
150 IAF operational planes took part in the last operation on Gaza. With accuracy and precision, they completed almost impossible missions. With attacks that caused tremendous damages to Hamas, and with as few as possible casualties, the IAF was the force leading the latest battle in the air, on the ground, and under it.
Following 11 days of the Israeli military bombing the Gaza Strip, which resulted in 253 Palestinians being killed, and more than 72,000 Palestinians being displaced, Palestinian officials said that it would cost approximately $100 million to rebuild the damage in Gaza. This region is already in poverty and continues to undergo an Israeli-sanctioned blockade. Israel, who was bombed by Hamas, resulting in 12 Israelis being killed, has an iron dome which intercepts about 85 to 95% of rockets to protect their region from bombings, highlighting the imbalance in fighting between both the countries. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised to de-escalate the situation, while NDP leader Jagmeet Singh has called for Canada to halt military exports to Israel. Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East have been campaigning for Canada's exports to Israel to come to an end.
We should be extracting ourselves from not just the arms trade, but from the relationship with Israeli industry in general. You know, it feeds into the overall system of occupation, and you can't really make a clear distinction between civilian and military purposes. It is perpetuating the occupation. It's perpetuating ethnic cleansing and apartheid. I do think we don't want to just stop producing things. We just want to make sure that the things that we are producing are benefiting society and that they're not perpetuating human rights violations.
Even if a suspension of Canadian military goods to Israel would not gainfully, you know, in 10 years suspend their ability to bomb buildings in Gaza, I think where it's important is it shows if Canada were to take that that position, we cannot in good conscience arm a country where we think that there is risk that these weapons are going to be used to violate human rights. And I think only that kind of pressure on the Israeli government is going to substantially change things generally, and I think substantially change things for the better, not only for Palestinians, but also for Israelis.
We're nearing the end of the hour. I'm going to finish this show by playing the speech that Rashida Tlaib gave last month in front of the U.S. Congress. As you know, Rashida Tlaib is a Palestinian-American congresswoman. She is the first Palestinian-American to be elected to Congress. And last month, she gave a speech in front of U.S. Congress during the attack on Gaza. You will see from this speech that Rashida Tlaib is contrary to the majority of U.S. politicians and Canadian politicians, as you heard our own foreign affairs minister categorically denying that Israel is an apartheid state despite the overwhelming evidence and reports that states the contrary. You will see that Rashida Tlaib is one of the few politicians who is not afraid to call apartheid what it is and is not afraid to state simple facts and to stand with basic human rights. So this is the speech that Rashida Tlaib gave in front of U.S. Congress in May.
I am the only Palestinian-American member of Congress now, and my mere existence has disrupted the status quo. I am so personal for me. I am a reminder to colleagues that Palestinians do indeed exist, that we are human, that we are allowed to dream. We are mothers, daughters, granddaughters. We are justice seekers and are unapologetically about our fight against oppressions of all forms. And colleagues, Palestinians aren't going anywhere, no matter how much money you send to Israel's apartheid government. If we are to make good on our promises to support equal human rights for all, it is our duty to end the apartheid system that for decades has subjected Palestinians to inhumane treatment and racism. Reducing Palestinians to live in utter fear and terror of losing a child, being indefinitely detained or killed because of who they are, and the unequal rights and protections they have under Israeli law. It must end. One of Israel's most prominent human rights organizations, B'Tselem, has declared Israel an apartheid state. Human Rights Watch recently recognized it too. This is what Palestinians living under Israel's oppression have been telling us for decades. I have been told by some of my colleagues who dispute the truth about segregation, racism, and violence in Israel towards Palestinians that I need to know the history. What they mean, unintentionally or not, is that Palestinians do not have the right to tell the truth about what happened to them during the founding of Israel. They are, in effect, In fact, they erase the truth about ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Israel that some refer to as the Nakba, our catastrophe. As Palestinians talk about our history, know that many of my Black neighbors, indigenous communities, may not know what we mean by Nakba, but they do understand what it means to be killed, expelled from your home, land, made homeless, and stripped of your human rights. My ancestors and current family in Palestine deserve the world to hear their history without obstruction. They have a right to be able to explain to the world that they are still suffering, still being dispossessed, still being killed as the world watches and does nothing. As Peter Beinart, an American of Jewish faith, writes, quote, "When you tell a people to forget its past, you are not proposing peace. You are proposing extinction. The Palestinian story is that of being made a refugee on the lands you called home. We cannot have an honest conversation about U.S. military support for the Israeli government today without acknowledging that for Palestinians, the catastrophe of displacement and dehumanization in their homeland has been ongoing since 1948. To read the statements from President Biden, Secretary Blinken, General Austin, and leaders of both parties, you'd hardly know Palestinians existed at all. There has been no recognition of the attack on Palestinian families being ripped from their homes in East Jerusalem right now, or home demolitions. No mention of children being detained or murdered. No recognition of a sustained campaign of harassment and terror by Israeli police against worshipers kneeling down and praying and celebrating their holiest days in one of their holiest places. No mention of Al-Aqsa being surrounded by violence, tear gas, smoke, while people pray. Can my colleagues imagine if it was their place of worship filled with tear gas? Could you pray as stun grenades were tossed into your holiest place? Above all, there has been absolutely no recognition of Palestinian humanity. If our own State Department can't even bring itself to acknowledge the killing of Palestinian children is wrong, well, I will say it for the millions of Americans who stand with me against the killing of innocent children, no matter their ethnicity or faith. I weep for all the lives lost under the unbearable status quo, every single one, no matter their faith, their background. We all deserve freedom, liberty, peace, and justice, and it should never be denied because of our faith or ethnic background. No child, Palestinian or Israeli, whoever they are, should ever have to worry that death will rain from the sky. How many of my colleagues are willing to say the same, to stand for Palestinian human rights as they do for Israelis? There is a crushing dehumanization to how we talk about this terrible violence. The New York Post reported that the Palestinian death toll as Israeli casualties. ABC says that Israelis are, quote, killed, while Palestinians simply, quote, die, as if by magic, as if they were never human to begin with. Help me understand the math. How many Palestinians have to die for their lives to matter? Life under apartheid strips Palestinians of their human dignity. How would you feel if you had to go through dehumanizing checkpoints, two blocks from your own home to go to the doctor or travel across your own land? How would you feel if you had to do it while pregnant in the scorching heat as soldiers with guns controlled your freedom? How would you feel it if you lived in Gaza, where your power and water might be out for days or weeks at a time, where you were cut off from the outside world by inhumane military blockade? Meanwhile, Palestinians' rights to nonviolent resistance have been curtailed and even criminalized. Our party leaders have spoken forcefully against BDS, calling its proponents anti-Semitic, despite the same tactics being critical to ending the South African apartheid mere decades ago. What we are telling Palestinians fighting apartheid is the same thing being told to my Black neighbors and Americans throughout that are fighting against police brutality here. There is no form of acceptable resistance to state violence. As long as the message from Washington is that our military support for Israel is unconditional, Netanyahu's extremism right-wing government will continue to expand settlements, continue to demolish homes, and continue to make the prospects for peace impossible. 330 of my own colleagues, and Democrats and Republicans here, 75% of the body here, signed a letter pledging that Israel shall never be made to comply with basic human rights laws that other countries that receive our military aid must observe. You know, when I see the images and videos of destruction and death in Palestine, all I hear are the children screaming from pure fear and terror. I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so that when we die together." And no one would live to mourn the loss of another one. The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees, and emboldens the apartheid policies that Human Rights Watch has detailed thoroughly in their recent report. I stand before you not only as a congresswoman for the beautiful 13 districts strong, but also as a proud daughter of Palestinian immigrants and the granddaughter of a loving Palestinian grandmother living in the occupied Palestine. You take that and you combine it with the fact that I was raised in one of the most beautiful, blackest cities in America, a city where movements for civil rights and social justice are birthed, the city of Detroit. So I can't stand here. I can't stand silent when injustice exists, where the truth is obscured. If there's one thing Detroit instilled in this Palestinian girl from Southwest, it's you always speak truth to power, even if your voice shakes. The freedom of Palestinians is connected to the fight against oppression all over the world. Lastly, to my city in Palestine, Ashanik and Awek of Hannah, I stand here because of you. Thank you.
And that's it for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You probably know that Under the Olive Tree is usually on Thursday at 11. This was a special episode. I hope you enjoyed it or learned something from it. If you want to learn more about Palestine Israel, join me again tomorrow at 11 a.m. at our usual time. We air weekly every Thursday from 11 to 12. And during that hour, we cover the latest news and topics related to Palestine Israel. And that's it. I am your host, Sausan Kadura. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Uncut. It contains strong language in some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
Peace and love, party people. It's Talib.